You are listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at opensocietyfoundations.org.
I want to say thank you, everyone, for coming today. This was really organized by Becca Vucho and Marina Pravdic, so I want to especially give a big shout out to Becca and Marina for organizing everything. And before we begin, I want to see that we see our foundation in Sarajevo. They'll be on the line, and we hope that they will participate during the session. I'll be calling on you. I want to give you guys a heads up on that. Do you hear us okay? Do you see us? Excellent. And it's going to be very exciting to have them participate. If you can see on the screen over there, there's a note from George Soros that calls for the opening of the foundation. So we'll be talking all about that today. You see Becca Vucho, who is responsible for all things in the Western Balkans and was also with the Open Society Foundations and did the very start of our work in the Balkans. Mark Malik Brown, I'm sure many of you know him. Mark was not with the foundations at the time, although he's now a member of the global board of the Open Society Foundations. And Mark was really instrumental in George Soros' first trip to Sarajevo. And I'm really looking forward to hearing Mark tell all of us about what that was like. And Arye Nair, who definitely needs no introduction. Arye Nair was president of the Open Society Foundations and was the founding president, and we're so delighted to have him here. And he'll talk about many things as we go through the day. And I'm Laura Silber, and the microphone is sort of on and off. So if we could first start out with showing a short film that we put together, which really tells the story of the founding of the efforts of the Open Society Foundations in Bosnia starting about 1993. And many of the people you see on the screen are also in the film. So if we can kick it off and maybe turn off the lights, that would be great.
Bosnia was kind of natural open society, if you will.
There were always three ethnic groups, Serbs, Croats, and Bosniaks.
I hope for an integrated country. Country with no hatred, violence, and this I hope for the rest of the Europe and world as well.
So that film lays out pretty nicely the situation for the foundation and what the aim of the foundation then and now is. And first of all, I want to salute you and Sarajevo, who, as you can see, played a role in the film and in all of our efforts in Bosnia. If you don't mind, we'll start out with Mark. Mark, if you could describe what it was like. How did it happen that George came to you and said, we have to do anything, something? And or did you go to him and say that?
No, this was very much one where George came to me. We knew each other, actually originally introduced by Arye, because in those days I earned my living as sort of mercenary on foreign elections, always working for exactly the kind of progressive candidates that George believed in. So my early relationship with George was, you know, he just took a sort of a secondary pleasure in watching me sort of working in places like Chile and the Philippines and occasionally trying to find ways he could help. But he knew that I had, before that, worked for the UN High Commissioner for Refugees. So as he cast around his, in those days, much more limited network than today to think who could help him think through what to do in Sarajevo, he called me on a Saturday morning, and, you know, it was a quite astonishing call, even by after 30 years now of having such calls from George, which is, how could I spend $50 million to save Sarajevo? You know, and I think I had one child on my lap and another one who I was trying to get her socks on and, you know, sort of put them down and said, say that again. And, you know, I have to say my first plan was not terribly successful, which was I thought that UNHCR as a UN agency would have access and that the best thing was to write a very large check to UNHCR, which we initially began to do, only to find that UNHCR, despite its best intentions as an intergovernmental UN agency, simply wouldn't cross the lines to deliver assistance inside Sarajevo. And that secondly, it was, you know, just extraordinarily cautious about criticizing what was going on inside Sarajevo. It would not call a genocide, and George rightly got increasingly impatient. So, you know, I found myself having to go back to UNHCR and asking for our money back, which doesn't usually happen in those. And, you know, we then constructed, very much with George's intimate engagement, as you can see from these photographs and his, you know, presence there in Sarajevo, we constructed an extraordinary two-part strategy. One was, as you heard in the film, the trying to repair the water and the electricity through a complete sort of rogue effort of an extraordinary Texan, who I know Arié will speak of, Fred Cooney, who'd worked with me on refugee programs in Southeast Asia, and who literally working with, again, those cited in the film, you know, we smuggled in the material to repair the water and electricity. And, you know, very much part of that was the guy with the mustache sitting beside George in the flight into Sarajevo, a guy called Lionel Rosenblatt, an ex-State Department official who'd, you know, equally colorful career, had smuggled Vietnamese who'd worked with America out of Vietnam on the eve of the fall of Saigon, a, you know, famous episode. So we were a pretty kind of colorful lot who didn't really respect any of the international rules. And Fred Cooney was famous in Sarajevo for the fact that he was so indignant at the lack of American support to what was going on that outside his house he flew a Texan flag as a mark of his indignation and independence from a government that he felt was failing. And so that was track one, to try and really do what the international community was signally failing to do, which was restore the basics of survival in the city. And track two was to begin a hell of an international row to try and force action. And, you know, we assembled an extraordinary group of individuals in Europe and the US. And I'm very sorry Mabel isn't with us, because as a very young advocate, Mabel was very instrumental in assembling that group. But we, you know, we sort of made the case relentlessly, conservatives, liberals, Jews, non-Jews, northerners, southerners. We had people like Prince Sadruddin Aga Khan involved. You know, all of us, that to our governments, that this simply they could not stand idly by as genocide occurred in the heart of Europe. And, you know, that advocacy campaign, I now am the chairman of the International Crisis Group that came out of this, and I'm always cautious about claiming credits for advocacy campaigns, because you know so many other voices and influences and factors weigh into changes of government policy. But this is one of those occasions where I think this campaign was singularly almost, but at least, you know, in a majority way of the factors that changed, responsible for changing Western policy towards Sarajevo. Dramas of Srebrenica and everything else obviously were the evidence for that, but the figures who just relentlessly worked the newsrooms and editorial boards of the New York Times and the Economist and the BBC, and who, you know, called on parliaments with just great vigor and governments and just simply wouldn't give up, were this network of people who came together as part of this coalition. And as I say, all inspired by George at the beginning. And, you know, it's a classic case. His money was important, but his energy and his leadership and his utter refusal to accept this tragedy in the heart of Europe this blight to his already emerging concept of open society was what I think, literally made the difference. Sarajevo owes a lot to George.
Thanks, Mark. At the time, I was a journalist covering the wars and the breakup of what was then Yugoslavia. And I remember, and it's a very different time, obviously, for journalism, but it was a time when there was this alliance, in a way, between the frustration on the part of the reporters who were covering the wars. And while there wasn't a unity or a unanimity of view, there was certainly a real frustration, which I think Mark touched on, from the press, too, in the sense of what we're reporting on, no one was working to stop. And the what we called then the international community seems so unable. So out of this, that effort which Mark was describing, if we could just, before we go to URA, if we could maybe talk to our colleagues in Sarajevo, Janana Hrvoja and Dobrila, you were on the ground. You both, Janana and Hrvoja, you were in the foundation at that point. Dobrila, you hadn't yet joined. If I could ask you maybe to say, what was it like when, whether it was Becca or George, who first made contact with you from the Open Society Foundations? When did you learn that we would start such an effort? And what did it feel like? After all, you were in the middle of a war.
As far as I can remember, the first person closely related to the foundation was, unfortunately, late Mr. Fred Cuny that came. And at the time, the foundation was still in the one room of the presidency building in the Constitutional Court. Zdravko Grebo got one room. And one day, simply Fred Cuny entered the room. He was a huge man like a mountain. Already that fact was kind of encouraging. He was radiating some kind of optimism, really, and immediately started to be very friendly and with no-nonsense talk. Already Grebo was talking with him how to do this or that, and that was, for me personally, my first contact with someone from outside world who is coming and is giving the impression that he is really willing to do something and that he can really do something and that doesn't much care about all the problems and all the obstacles that will probably and assuredly will be against all these efforts. And that's one of my most vivid memories from those times. It was winter, 93 towards 94. I'm very vivid with chronology. Later, Becca came. Becca brought me one book that I asked to read, and that was also very important, you know, that someone is coming, apart from all other much, much more important things. You are supplied with the book from one of your favorite authors, so you can kind of still be in touch with the normal living and live like a normal human being, reading books and things like that. And that was one of the most important part in Soros' effort in Bosnia, apart from this humanitarian effort in classical terms, all these things which are rather well known, from water to electricity and all these things, this effort to sustain the cultural life in the besieged city. As a part of our message to the outside world that we are normal human beings with normal human needs and that it's not quite a proper thing to be killed just like that. And that was also kind of a message ourselves to ourselves that we are still human beings and that we want to live normally, to have a theater and things like that. Later, Susan Sontag came. Also, the foundation was involved in her first visit. And later she was producing the Godot in besieged Sarajevo. And I could go on with this.
Hrvoje, that's really helpful for bringing to life and also making apparent what was distinct about George Soros' approach was giving the elements of cultural life or the newsprint. Arye, how did you think of things like that?
Well, it did seem to me very important to try to sustain the cultural life of the city of Sarajevo. It was very important to the people with whom I was in contact with Sarajevo, and so it became very important to me. And I got into trouble with the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees staff in Zagreb, who controlled the flights into Sarajevo, because I brought Susan Sontag with me into Sarajevo and listed her as a humanitarian worker and tried to persuade them unsuccessfully that sustaining the cultural life of the city of Sarajevo had something to do with humanitarian work. So they were furious at me for doing that. I want to tell one story about Susan's arrival, and it suggests something significant about the city of Sarajevo. The night we arrived was, I think, one of the worst points in the war. It was April 1993. And I had come with Susan, and her son, David Reif, was also there because David was a journalist covering the war in Bosnia, and he was able to get in on that basis. And Zdravko Grebo was the director of the foundation. So that evening, we wanted to go out for a drink someplace, and Zdravko told us there were two places open. There was a place that served vodka because the Ukrainian soldiers in Sarajevo with the UN provided it with vodka. And there was a place serving red wine because the French soldiers were providing red wine. So we chose a red wine. And so there were the four of us at the tables, Zdravko, Susan, David, and me. And at a certain point, somebody got up from a nearby table and approached Susan Sontag. And those of you who remember Susan know that she was quite distinctive looking, and said, "Are you Susan Sontag?" And she said, "Yes." And he said, "Would you mind joining our table for a while?" So she agreed. And then as the three of us remained at our table, we watched one person after another from other tables in the same place approach Susan. And before the evening was out, she had sat at every table in the bar. And I was saying to David Reif, "Can you imagine any bar in New York where everybody would want to sit and talk with Susan Sontag?" But it was important to people to sustain the cultural life. You saw in the film Haris Pasovic, who staged the Sarajevo Film Festival. And at a certain point, a number of well-known film actors wanted to go to Sarajevo to take part in the film festival. And they were blocked by the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. And at that moment, I was with Sadako Ogata, who was then the High Commissioner, and I was asked to intercede. The actors I remember were Daniel Day-Lewis, Jeremy Irons, and Vanessa Redgrave. There were some others, but those are the names that I remember. And again, I tried to make the plea to Mrs. Ogata that the cultural life was important to the humanitarian effort in Sarajevo, and she was having nothing of it. So I lost that particular round, and they were unable to attend the film festival. If I may, while I have the floor, Mark talked about Fred Kuhne, and Hervoy talked about Fred Kuhne, and he was, for us, really the hero of the entire effort. Fred was a humanitarian assistance specialist. He was regarded as the master of disaster. One of the persons who served on our five-member committee to determine how George's $50 million would be spent was Morton Abramowitz, who was at one time U.S. ambassador to Turkey, at another time U.S. ambassador to Thailand. And Mort had worked with Fred Cuney, particularly when the Kurds fled from Saddam Hussein's Iraq into to Turkey and Iran, a flight of about 2 million people. So Mort knew about Fred's capacity to do humanitarian work. And he took on an extraordinary series of projects. The best known is the water project. And the water project was this. Fred observed that a lot of the people who were being killed by sniping from the hills around Sarajevo had gone to old wells that supplied the brewery in Sarajevo to collect water in plastic jugs and to bring the water back home because there was no other source of clean water. And with the water, they were moving very slowly. And so they were very easy targets for the snipers on the hills. And a lot of people were getting killed, dragging water. They had children's carts and in the winter, children's sleds on which to drag the plastic bottles of water. So Fred decided that there was a place that the river that goes through Sarajevo passed near mountain, a hill, and that there was an old road tunnel that went through that hill. And so what he did with the help of a Sarajevo engineer who was part Bosnian, part Kosovar, Faruk Shlako. They designed a very long, narrow water purification system so that it could fit in a road tunnel. It was 200 meters long, and Fred got it manufactured in Texas and then rolled onto UN relief flights coming into Sarajevo. And he had it timed so that within seconds, the sections of this water purification system would be pulled by trucks off the UN relief flights and then trucked to that tunnel under the hill. And because of the hill, the Bosnian Serb shelling wouldn't do any damage to the water purification system within the tunnel. And in that way, he got clean water to most of the residents of Sarajevo. He couldn't get the water to people who lived on the hills because gravity wouldn't get it to them. So he built a separate small water purification system and got the Jordanian troops in Bosnia with the UN to guard the small water purification system to serve the people on the hill. But all of his projects had that level of ingenuity, that sense that you could overcome any problem. And those humanitarian projects used up a fair amount of the money that George provided, but they really helped the city of Sarajevo to survive.
Thanks. We'll definitely be back to you. Now, Becca has laryngitis, so she'll have difficulty speaking, but we have to be patient. And just to say that Mabel Van Aranje couldn't make it today because of the snow yesterday in London, so she's flying as we speak, so we miss her. Becca, you were on that first flight with George Soros. You were probably one of the few people, if not the only person, from the region at that flight. What was it like for you? What did George say on the flight? I imagine it was very noisy because it was a C-130, but what was it like? What was that atmosphere like? And what did you expect to find? And how soon after did you meet Hrdvoje and Jenana when you got to Sarajevo?
I do apologize, really. I will try my best. That was not my first time that I went to Sarajevo. I went before that. But it just happened that George decided to go. And it was November of 1993. And he was in Sarajevo the day when the Mostar Bridge was bombed. The same day when this happened. We were in Sarajevo, so we actually not only went to Sarajevo, but also we were there when this terrible thing happened.
To interrupt to say, so when the Mostar Bridge was bombed, the person who was named responsible was the man Slobodan Praljak, who recently committed suicide in the Yugoslav War Crimes Tribunal by swallowing poison after the verdict of guilty was passed. So it was quite a downer.
You could get to Sarajevo either through Zagreb, Split, or Ancona on special flights. You had to have a UN a special permission, and you would never know when you could get on the plane. You could sit 1 week in Split and wait for the ceasefire to get on the plane. So when finally George decided to go, we were not very happy because, you know, security issues. But you saw a lot of pictures there with him with a flag jacket. And I have to tell you one little anecdote. Before we were going, his wife called me and said, "Do you know where you're taking him?" I said, "Well, I am not taking him. It's his desire." So I was warned that we have to take good care. So we did. And you saw probably the pictures of George in the flag jacket with a helmet for the duration of the flight. We flew from Zagreb, and I was extremely nervous because we had no idea what will happen. There was no armored cars at that point. The foundation did not have, in 1993, an armored car. We bought one later on. So actually, when we got in the car after the airport, the driver was driving extremely fast. And I said, "Could you please slow down?" He said, "No, we just have to be faster than those rifles from the hill above." So I was extremely nervous, but at the same time, proud that he wanted to come and that we did our best. The second anecdote is we stayed at the famous Holiday Inn Hotel, which, of course, did not have electricity, water, and so on. So we had these very heavy vests, and we were given bottles of water. So we started going up the stairs, and he said, "This is very heavy, this vest. Could you take it, please?" So I had my vest and his vest and the water to carry up those steps. We got into the room, and he said, "What do I do now with these bottles of water?" I said, "Well, you try to wash your hands." So there was a lot of anecdotes, but it was amazing because that evening at the Sarajevo Hotel, we also managed to get a little reception. And we invited a lot of people. They all came, and we provided food for people who really were without food for so long. So there was a lot of anecdotes, but it's really, fortunately, everything went very smoothly, and he was very cautious, and there are pictures here from the plane. In the middle, this was actually a cargo plane that we flew, and in the middle between these seats were actually pipes, and those were the pipes for the gas project that Fred Cuny provided. And it was really Fred who organized everything so that it went so smoothly. And it was amazing. It was an amazing visit that I will never forget in my life.
Janana, you were there that day that George Soros arrived. What was it like? What did you expect? Were you worried that it would amount to nothing in the sense of that? What did you think would be accomplished by it?
To be very honest, I didn't have any expectations in terms of accomplishments, bigger accomplishments. What I was amazed, what amazed me the most is the mere fact of our colleagues coming to the besieged city. The prevailing feeling during the siege was the one that you were left out, cut off from the rest of the world, that you are in isolation and that you're left to the mercy of the soldiers, you know, around the city. So the very fact of the colleagues coming to the city in dangerous, actually, conditions was something that brought us hope that, you know, we were not left alone. And that meant a lot. And I don't think we ever actually said that to our colleagues, to Mr. Nair, to Beka Vucic. Beka Vucic came, I think, most often, and of course, Mr. Soros. We never actually said how much we appreciate that. I saw it as an act of collegiality, actually.
Mark, you and Arye have both known George for decades. This was not the typical philanthropy for George. This was something unusual. Did you talk at the time with George? Why do you think George was motivated? Was it a sense of that he could act on the international stage? Was it because of his experience as a child, as a boy growing up in Budapest? Could you shed any light on what do you think were some of the motivating factors for George?
Well, yes, although I'll be interested in Arye's answer to it as well. But, you know, I think it was, you know, a mixture of things. One, he was finding his stride as an advocate for open society. This, after all, came after the huge success that the foundation had had at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall and the years around that. You know, arguably still, all these decades later, its single most impactful set of interventions. And so, you know, I think George had suddenly, you know, gathered a huge ambition to and recognition that the right kind of interventions could make extraordinary transformational change. I think the second was this view of how could this happen at the heart of Europe, that, you know, a Berlin Wall that had gone down around issues of, you know, spreading freedom and openness and democracy, you know, suddenly faced this challenge. And so a strategic sense that this had to be resisted and defeated. And you know, the coalition of people he brought together, as I said, represented very disparate political ideologies, came from different religious or not necessarily actively religious, but different religious traditions. So, you know, I mentioned we had a Muslim prince in our number, as well as, you know, someone like George, but also very much a practicing Jew like Mort Abramowitz and others. So it was, and obviously a lot of us just straight, mild-mannered Christians as well. So, you know, and I think for George, all of that was, you know, very important because, you know, he saw that, you know, the extraordinary sort of miracle of Europe, a place where people have been able to live together over centuries despite religious and other differences, and in fact at their best have celebrated those differences and been much more than the straightforward sum of them, that all that vision of Europe that he had, you know, come to from the horrors of his sort of childhood in Hungary seemed to him endangered by what was happening in Sarajevo. If this could happen in Sarajevo, what then for London and Paris and other places later? So, you know, I think he really felt this was the front line of the fight for what kind of Europe it was going to be. But there was within it this sort of anomalous thing, which is, you know, gone on bedeviling the foundation almost ever since, which was George's view as an investor that humanitarian assistance is very bad value for money. That, you know, your money goes out, people have kept going today, but, you know, it doesn't provide a solution. And what I think, therefore, was very powerful for him about what we were able to do in this case was the humanitarian actions both allowed things to be held together till a political solution could be found, but through their sheer bravura and challenging of conventional wisdom, Fred and his pipes, you know, blew away the official consensus that nothing could be done to save Sarajevo. And in that sense, I think it put political solutions on the table that otherwise people would have ducked and avoided. So here was, you know, humanitarian investment, which actually, in the longer term, transformed the political and therefore the economic prospects of Sarajevo. So I think, you know, it's echoed down through the life of the foundation since this challenge. Okay, we'll do humanitarian assistance, but as long as it can have that kind of payoff, and it's, to be honest, rather hard to replicate Sarajevo every time.
And I think part of it for George at the time was, and he said it since, is that humanitarian spending was a defeat. It meant failure. It meant that we had failed to prevent a disaster. So it's not only the investment, but it really is a sense of that all political efforts had failed. Arye, George has often said when you were running the foundation that he left human rights and justice to you. At this time, you were thinking about what to do, how to bring the leaders, the people responsible for what was happening in Sarajevo and across former Yugoslavia to justice. What was going on behind the scenes? And can you talk a little bit about your role and the idea behind forming the International Criminal Tribunal?
When George first called me about this, I was still at Human Rights Watch. And sometime before this, we had issued a report for the first time using the term war crimes in the title of the report. And I issued it with a call for the establishment of an international criminal tribunal to deal with the situation. One reason that this was novel at the time is that international humanitarian law in that era was quite different from what it is today. The only place in the Geneva Conventions in which there are references to war crimes, or in the language of the Geneva Conventions, grave breaches, are the sections dealing with international armed conflict. And so in those days, we did not think that you could deal with abuses in an internal armed conflict as war crimes. And you couldn't establish an international tribunal to deal with that. But in the case of Bosnia, there were three internationally recognized states. There was the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, which was Serbia and Montenegro. There was Croatia, and Bosnia-Herzegovina had been internationally recognized. So this was an international armed conflict. And so the concept of war crimes applied as international humanitarian law was then regarded. So I took advantage of that to issue a call for an international tribunal. The call would have fallen without a trace, except that it exactly coincided with the publication of news articles about camps in Bosnia, that is Omarska and Karatem. A journalist named Roy Gutman published the first stories. And the day that he published those stories in New York Newsday, the State Department officer was asked at the noon press briefing whether the State Department had information confirming Roy Gutman's stories about these camps. And the State Department spokesman said yes. And then it was a news story everywhere that the State Department had said that there were these camps. And camps reminded everyone of the Nazis. And so suddenly this call for an international criminal tribunal was something people picked up. It was a way of trying to respond to this idea of camps. And when George allocated the $50 million for Bosnia, I went to my fellow members of the committee that would disperse the funds, Mark and Morton Abramowitz and Prince Sadruddin Aga Khan and a Swiss general, Air Force general named Kurt Ballinger. And I asked them, could I use $2 million of the $50 million for the human rights cause? And with that, I used the money to try to promote the establishment of an international criminal tribunal. The UN had agreed to establish a commission on war crimes before it established a tribunal, but it gave the commission no money. And so we gave it money out of that $2 million, and the MacArthur Foundation matched our contribution, and they had money, and they published five volumes on the war crimes that were being committed in Bosnia and other parts of the former Yugoslavia. And that and the various other activities that we supported out of the $2 million helped create the momentum for the establishment of an international criminal tribunal. And then in January 1993, George actually allocated the money in December 1992, but we had started this even before the money was formally allocated on the basis that he had pledged this amount of money. Madeleine Albright became the U.S. representative to the United Nations, and she grabbed hold of the issue and helped to push it. And by May 1993, the U.N. Security Council had approved a resolution establishing the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. Then the headaches really began, because initially it was non-functional, and it took us quite a while to actually get it moving, but eventually that did take place.
I remember covering the first case at the tribunal, and it was an amazing thing to all of us.
Cottage case.
Yeah, just to see it come alive, that this kind of thing that had seemed so like riddled with so many problems, not even to mention, I mean, the fact that the parties on the ground, many of, you know, the Serbian side most emphatically, didn't recognize it. So.
No, and look, it had no capacity to get people in front of it. This first case that Laura mentioned was a man named Dusko Tadic. He had been a guard at one of these camps, a low-level person. And then the Bosnian Serbs wanted to draft him in their army. And so he left Bosnia and went to Germany, went to Munich to escape the draft. And on the streets of Munich, survivors of that camp recognized him. The German authorities took him into custody and turned him over to the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia. And that's how the tribunal got its first case. And except for that series of events, it would have had absolutely nothing to do in that earlier period. Later on, things changed. Tony Blair is reviled these days, but he appointed a foreign secretary named Robin Cook. And Robin Cook wanted to make the tribunal work. And so he had British troops in Bosnia arrest people who were wanted as war criminals. And that's really how the tribunal started to take off.
And while the court was getting underway, the foundation was also operating. And Becca, you were in frequent touch, frequently visiting the foundations. How, one of the things the foundations are best known for, I think, were the scholarships of that day and the fact that so many people from former Yugoslavia, from Bosnia, went abroad to continue their studies. And if you could say a little bit about that, we also have Martha Lurkey here in the audience. So just to hear a little bit about that whole program and how much it meant.
Again, I apologize for my voice, but I was in the Balkans, so that's why. So in 1992, I was called by a friend of mine, Celia Hawksworth. She's a professor. At that time, she was a professor at the London University of Serbo-Croatian language and literature. That's how it was called at the time. And she said, what are we going to do? I have tons of people from Bosnia, Serbia here. Can George give something to them? They want to study, but we have to help them. So that's how actually the idea began. So I went to Georgian Area, and they approved the first batch of money, so to say. And then I formed a board. It was a board from all the former Yugoslav people who had to escape Yugoslavia at the time, whether they had to go because of the political reasons or they just were avoiding the draft or whatever reason. And they were in Paris, Amsterdam, Austria, and so on. So we actually started the program. But I will ask Martha, who then took over the program as a scholarship director of OSF, and the program was established in 1993, and we closed it officially in 2000 with a huge conference in Budapest. But actually, she can tell you a little bit more, but I think it's so amazing when you today meet some of those people who have come back to Bosnia, or you just meet them somewhere else. And when they said that a small supplementary grant that we gave them, maybe $500, $1,000, meant so much at that particular moment. Martha, please.
I won't say too much, except to say that the basic data was somewhere over 2,000 grants given over a period of 5 years with an extension for renewals so that the students could continue their studies. The amount spent is really not about the money, but it was somewhere around $20 million. And I'll just share perhaps that the committee the board that Becca brought together was incredible. And I had just started at the foundations at that time in December 1994. And I have to say that a lot of the learning curve that I went through in those years of that selection process, I would like to thank you, Becca, because I learned a ton. That committee was incredible. That was some of the hardest decisions I've ever seen anyone having to make, and certainly some of the hardest I ever had to make in this foundation.
Unfortunately, we have lost touch with many of people because at the time, many of them did not want to be named by name. And we completely, really, appreciated that. We also published a book, which is called Children of Atlantis, because after we received the first essays that they wrote as part of the application process, we were just stunned what was written in those applications. So, actually, the CEU Press published the book, with a wonderful photograph on the cover by Gilles Perez, who really extensively covered the war in Bosnia. And that book is a testament that many of those people today are somewhere in the world, we don't know where, or many of them came to Bosnia, and I know that for sure, but that we at the moment really changed their lives in a way.
I had the privilege of running, we were doing a film on the scholarships and the role that George Soros and the program has played, and I ran across the scholars from scholarship recipients from former Yugoslavia, and there was a physicist from MIT and a breast cancer specialist in Yale and the kind of in the hard sciences, and then you would meet some poets and some
Bosnian ambassador to the UN.
Unbelievable range of people who I think it really made the difference. Mark, one of the people I met was someone called Zlata Filipovic. She wrote something called Zlata's Diary that we played a role in supporting her. And I met her actually years after the war at an ICG benefit dinner. And when we opened this session today, you talked about that was one of the ICG's great advocacy triumphs. ICG was really born in that moment, and I'd love to hear something about it. I know that you and George and Mort Abramowitz played a huge role, played the role in founding it. And if you could tell us that story of how the organization came to be and about your conversations with George, it's really a fascinating one, and that the fact that ICG still plays such an important role today.
Well, yes, and you're right. I mean, ICG came out of this. It was a child of the success there rather than in any way the author of it. The success was very much the foundation's, OSF's, in its earlier incarnation. But on not the trip that George went in, but on a separate trip, Mort Abramowitz and I went in, and it was just when the tide politically and in military terms had turned and it was clear that NATO was going to end the siege of Sarajevo. And it was a very dangerous trip for that reason, because I think there were quite a few people who would have liked to have taken a shot at Mort or myself for what was emerging as the role we had played as a group in this. But as we sort of took one of these Hercules planes out and corkscrewed up into the air to avoid being shot at, you know, Mort leans across on the Hercules and says to me, you know, we did this pretty well. We should do it again. And out of that sort of airplane yelling at each other as you do in a Hercules, because there's so much noise and Mort was wearing this silly tin helmet, they always say to politicians, never wear a tin helmet, even if you're inspecting a tank. You know, it did for Dukakis when he ran for president, those of you who remember it. Well, Mort looked every bit as absurd in this tin hat as he leant over to me and said, you know, we should do it again. And what we realized was that this thing that we'd ended up finding our way to modeling in Sarajevo of, you know, a high-powered advocacy with real thought and attention given by first-class policymakers to what were possible solutions to this terrible thing, so that when we went to see governments, we weren't just saying, you've got to do something, but we're putting down in front of them a blueprint for what they could do, and being willing to sort of put behind that pressure through the media and, you know, a much noisier, louder campaign in support of the sort of policy recommendations and the discussions with senior officials that entailed. We thought, you know, here's something that can work. And it was out of that concept that the crisis group was born. Now, at the beginning, we had a second idea in the crisis group, because it really was a child of Sarajevo, which was we wanted to keep Fred Cooney and the pipes. And we imagined that, a second strand would be that kind of activist humanitarianism that would actually shame governments into recognizing there were solutions and that you could fix problems and would add to us. And, you know, tragically, Fred was to die soon afterwards on a mission for the foundation in Central Asia. And
Chechnya.
Chechnya, and that you know, that sort of leg to ICG sort of died with him. And we've just become the policy and advocacy organization. But as I say, you know, whatever successes Crisis Group has had since, you know, the model has, you know, remained profoundly founded on that experience of Sarajevo.
I'd like to turn to our colleagues in Sarajevo. And as the war raged on, so after this initial humanitarian intervention by George Soros, and then in time the international community got its act together to deliver humanitarian aid, inside the foundation, how did you continue operating during the war years as 93, 94, 95? How did you continue to operate, and how did you sustain from the programs such as education programs and other things? How did you function in these circumstances?
Well, at the very beginning, there were just three or four, something like that. And rather so, it was Grebo. There was one guy who was very short there. And we had our lawyer, Kemal Alekovic, who is still with us as our collaborator. And Hazim Kazic, three of us operators. But it was first month or two. And then the foundation was, please, it seems to me, apart from all this extraordinary situation, and that it was the humanitarian aid touch was huge stamp on it all. I think that also there was an intention that the Bosnian Foundation should kind of work as any normal Soros foundation in the world, and to develop the blueprint how the local foundations are working. So we had the vocabulary of the foundation that was actual at the time, and this notion of programs, like media program, for instance, that was entitled to me, and then culture. And very soon it was obvious, we were joined by our colleague Ognjen as the operative director, and the job was accumulating. And so Zdravko Grebo was working on bringing up more people. So it came, then came Aida Cengic, Jenana, and Amela Hadrović. So the staff was growing, and we had an array of programs. And of course, it was not a normal social life in general, normal cultural situation, but all of these programs were developing approaches as if the situation was normal. And we were offering our help in all these domains of normal life, apart from the humanitarian, various humanitarian actions. We were gathering people from media, people from culture, and discuss. They were approaching us with the projects. We would say to them what we would like to do, and they were offering their ideas to do things. Now, there are many things. For instance, in media program, there was one project, a huge thing. It was already mentioned, I think, this 200 tons of print paper that was imported in Sarajevo. It was a kind of a really special operation, and Fred Cuny was, of course, engaged in it. Normally, it was treated as a strategic material by the guys around the city. However, we managed to put that print paper in the city. Of these 200 tons, the healthy was 6 tons was lost, which is naturally. And all this paper wasn't only for the newspapers, but for anything that you could print. Textbooks, books, various kind of materials, anything that you could print was on this print paper. I think there are many copies of these books and things that were printed on that paper. The culture program was getting this momentum, and we were kind of a ministry of culture, so to say, in Sarajevo, because of course there were no other funding at the time for the culture, and the spirit of this cultural battle was developing. And although you could be a bit cynical about it, that with culture you cannot be tanks and shells, but you can rise your spirit, so that in a sense you can, all this suffering is kind of, it's easier to suffer when you, okay, you have a day with shells and everything, and you are trying to get the water and things like that, but in the evening you go to the theater, and all these things are kind of dubious, but at the day you maybe saw two or three people dying in front of your eyes. But then in the evening you go to the theater. There is something strange in it, but the strangeness is a part of a human life. And in condition of Sarajevo, I think it was okay. In the end, we are behaving in a kind of a special ways. And I leave that to sociologists, psychologists, and philosophers still to these days. Of course, it wasn't like that just in Sarajevo. There are notorious stories from Nazi camps, and I think it's a normal. And Foundation was hugely participating in these things and developing all these activities and fields of activity. So although we had a touch of humanitarian aid, for instance, in media program, we were ready to develop any newspaper, even those that we knew that maybe in the future we will not help them. But at the moment we were going like with the philosophy of anything that can flourish, help them and create a normal situation in which you can choose. Then later you can choose. And the transgression towards normality was in few post-war years. I remember when Mr. Soros came in 1996, and we had on the parting breakfast in Hotel Bosnia. Will this be correct? I'm not sure if I quote correctly, but he said, well, those heroic times are past for us now, and probably this foundation cannot be in these terms as it was such a big thing anymore, but you don't have to be bothered with that. We are lucky that we can go living normally now and work, try to work as normally and as usual, and war belongs to the past. So the foundation became more and more normal, like any other in the network. World and in the network, and continued with working and developing. And at one moment, we were quite a huge institution, I think, up to the year 2000.
Thank you. Before we go to questions, Arya, I wanted to ask you, often in situations, an organization reflects the external realities of the war, rivalries. What was it like heading the foundation, and Becca, in your position as well, when various members of what was first a Yugoslav foundation, which was first a foundation for all a country of 23 million, and as the country fractured, and independent foundations were forming with people whose countries were fighting against each other. How did you navigate that, and what happened both internally and also on the ground?
I don't think it was difficult to navigate that. That is, although the countries were fighting against each other, the people in the different foundations, in the different parts of the former Yugoslavia, were basically united in their antagonism to ethnic nationalism, and they saw themselves engaged in the same cause. The foundation in Croatia was very much involved in the efforts on behalf of the Bosnian refugees in Croatia. There were Bosnian refugees also in Macedonia And similarly, the Macedonian Foundation was very involved in the support of the Bosnian refugees. But the foundation in Serbia, which also established at that stage a branch in Kosovo before it became an independent Kosovo foundation, and a foundation in Slovenia, involved people who knew each other. They had been involved in opposition to ethnic nationalism prior to the outbreak of the conflicts in the former Yugoslavia, and they did not descend into nationalism themselves. So there were different roles that we had to play. For example, in Serbia, or then the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, there were sanctions against Yugoslavia. But the sanctions also included or blocked medical supplies. And so we played a role during that period in helping to get medical supplies into to Serbia, because they had been victimized, or the people who needed the medical care in Serbia had been victimized because of the actions of the Milosevic government. Becker dealt with the foundations on a day-to-day basis much more than I did. But Becker, am I right that this was not difficult?
Well, no, it was not difficult. No, it was really the act of balancing people, individuals, and I think we have to remember that was the time with no internet, no phones, no communication, what we have today. But we managed to really communicate somewhat. I was traveling throughout the Balkans as much as I could, and after the Dayton Accords were signed in November of 1995, I organized the first meeting of all the foundations in the spring of 1996 in Ljubljana. We kind of felt Ljubljana is the safest, and I think it was actually at that point. So it was an amazing moment when people, as Arya mentioned, many of them knew each other from former Yugoslavia, when Zdravko Grebo met Rastko Močnik, when Carmen and Puchovski came and met Vlada Milčin. For the first time, actually, we helped them. I think at that time also the visa regimes were much easier. We also, at that time, as Arya mentioned, we had a branch office in Kosovo, but also we had a branch office in Novi Sad, in Vojvodina, as well as in Podgorica, in Montenegro. And in 1999, after the bombing, we actually went a little bit ahead of the history and opened the individual foundations in two big countries, Kosovo and Montenegro. So we continued with these annual meetings, and then slowly the phones and internet were coming. Today, of course, that's not a problem. But I think that those were really days of balancing and being very sensitive to many of the issues. I remember when Hrvoje came for the first time out of Sarajevo, we invited him to a huge media conference in Ohrid that Mr. Soros attended, with because media was, I think, aside from the humanitarian aid, one of the most important things that we were fighting at that time. Radio, print media, television, and so on. Hrvoje was like out of the cage, out of the ghetto. And, you know, he's very thin in his life. Anyway, he's very thin today as well. And we all thought that he's so thin because he, you know, did not have food and all this stuff. Not really. He looks almost the same. But sitting with him and George and talking about Bosnia was really things that one cannot forget. So we did manage to balance and communicate in spite of the really terrible difficulties.
And Mark, you've worn so many hats in your life, and I remember when I was a journalist, I would call you, and I think you were at the World Bank at that point, and you've seen both from working within a humanitarian, working with a humanitarian organization, working at a humanitarian organization, in journalism, in government. What was it about the peculiar alchemy of this initiative? Could we just say it's George Soros? Could we say it's the people who are all on this panel and in the foundation in Sarajevo? What made this so memorable and have such a lasting impact and such an important thing at the time, but also something that we remember so well?
No, well, I mean, you can't sort of have lived a life seeing as many crises unfold and get resolved in some cases and not resolved in others without realizing the extraordinary importance of the confluence of individuals and events. And, you know, the word lucky doesn't seem to belong in a sentence about Sarajevo at that time, but we got lucky because there were journalists like you and Samantha Power trying to write also from Sarajevo and Srebrenica and many others who, you know, just kept on banging away at the conscience of the West and who did manage to sort of, you know, persuade their editors, because you were all women who it's very hard to say no to, and you were disproportionately women, actually, if I recall correctly, who were out there as stringers and different ways. Maybe they didn't get such front page billing from their editors. I don't know. They were a pretty formidable group of journalists, anyway. And you know, and then it was sort of, we got lucky with our politicians too. We, in a number of countries, you know, were seeing political change in the UK from a conservative government that didn't want to know anything about this to a Labour government under Blair. In the US, you know, a Clinton administration that, you know, on the one hand was wary of engagements, on the other hand, you know, didn't, it was also a little bit believed in the same ethical foreign policy that we'd seen elsewhere. So all sorts of things came together. But I don't think that takes away from the catalytic importance of what George and many in this room did, you know, because they sort of framed the issues and set the arguments and exposed Sarajevo to that international spotlight that ultimately forced the hand of policymakers to make a difference. But as I say, you know, I wish it was so simple. One could just say, thank you, George, for doing that. It's never like that. And it's, you know, a lot of different activities came together in this particular anthill, and it made a difference.
Thank you. I'd like to turn to the audience to see if there are any questions, comments for any of the panelists. And if I could ask you to take a, in the back, if you can take a, Marina has the microphone.
Hi, my name's Mark. Thank you for being here. Enjoyed the discussion here. I've been to Sarajevo a number of times and have a lot of friends there. And they tell me it's worse off now than it was 10 years ago or even 20 years ago. So I wanted to ask, how do you evaluate the impact of the civil society organizations that were founded by Soros? And maybe give an example of the most successful one. Thank you so much.
Terrific. I'd like to turn to Dobrila Govedarica, who is head of the foundation, and she should be somewhere. Hi, Dobrila.
Hi to all. After 25 years operation in Bosnia, I would say that that Soros Foundation was the key to development of civil society here. There is a wide range of different organizations and different fields that they cover. And we as a foundation are considered as a partner to them, not just a donor. We do not have a classical bureaucratic approach to civil society. We are here to help, to assist, to understand. And being locals with the local board that practically ran the foundation, we are probably the best one to understand what this society deserves and needs. Thank you.
Becca?
I just want to add, for people who don't know, we also have an office in Banja Luka where we have two staff members. We opened the office just after the Dayton Accord as a media center because that was the easiest way to register the office. But today it's a branch office of our foundation in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And we, as Dobrila explained, we operate on all the territories, including, of course, Mostar, where we have a number of projects. So the civil society is really, we try from many angles to help them. And I think what she said is that really the strength of what happened in the 90s really, in a way, resembles today's operations of the foundation.
And, because Mark at the back said that things are much worse now than 20 years before CIC. I'd love to hear somebody answer that point because it's, yeah.
And I was actually going to answer it. I think part of it is the frustration, and you and Sarajevo obviously know better, but it's the frustration with the political situation, with the unbelievably complicated constitution of their 13, I think, separate constitutions and with the Dayton Agreement. And it's really difficult to govern, and with the lack of political will from the political parties. And so there's so many obstacles to a running a country and to governance and to participation that I think the lack of economic prospects, the lack of political prospects, and all of that, I think, is what has made it feel to some, perhaps, the lack of prospects for the future. But I don't know that it's a failure of civil society. I think it's really the political and economic realities of Bosnia and the Balkans today. Other questions?
Okay. Yes. I was trained in foreign policy and did work as a foreign policy analyst early in my career, but I was at no time a Balkans specialist. I worked for support of Bosnia and have Western involvement to support the Bosnians in the early 90s, but still don't have special expertise. I'm wondering if you could take a few moments just to update myself, this audience, about the psychological and social dimensions of what's going on in Yugoslavia today. About a year or so ago, I met a woman, a Serbian woman in her 20s, who said her family had to leave Serbia because they were westernized. They didn't believe in a Serbian myth of the whole world's against us. We never did any atrocities, and Serbia is under siege. And she said, and they had this Western, more open attitude, and they were so reviled by their neighbors that they felt compelled to emigrate. So it wasn't. And so I'm wondering, to what extent are the people of the former Yugoslavia still, perkering in these old hatreds, or to what extent are they learning to live together and leaving them behind? I mean, I don't know, and I'm wondering about this.
I can take a stab at it, but if unless anyone in Sarajevo wants to answer that.
Actually, it is not about the people. It's about political class. Since they captured the country, they provide the jobs, they control everything, and they would like to have their own people with them, submissive, of course. If the people are let to live peacefully, I would say that Bosnia would soon become close to normality. But political leaders practically provoke every day with some crisis, all of them, all three of them. And they feed the people with the fear. When you live in the fear, especially young people, you would try to find some better place for you. We lost more than 100 young people in past 3 years. They realized that there is no real prospect in this country. It is difficult. And build their life here. And if I may add, I belong to a minority in Sarajevo. I was there during the war, and I still live there, and I don't have any problem. So if you do not need a job from the government, if you are more or less independent, and there are a lot of such people working for or businesses or some internationals, they can live normally in Sarajevo as anywhere else. So if I can repeat, it is not about the people, it's about political class.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear your name. So. Okay, well, we will have to organize our second panel for your topic, because this is really a huge issue and a huge question which we cannot really generalize. There are parts of the Balkans which are getting better, there are parts of the Balkans that are stagnating, and that there are parts of the Balkans that are coming down, going down. So depends where we are, at what moment, political moment. And I agree with Dobrila that it is really the political will that is really driving the region at this moment. There are a lot of good things that have happened since the wars, but there are a lot of bad things as well. So it's really something that we have to really wait and see. I'm willing to talk, but I really think that we cannot say in one sentence, because today's Macedonia is very different from the one 3 months ago. Today's Serbia is somewhat different than a couple of years ago, and so on and so on. Today's Kosovo, again, is a country that is not yet recognized by 4+2 countries in Europe, so that it cannot really go forward toward the European Union. So there are a lot of political obstacles which are keeping the Balkans. And yes, there is a lot of people who are leaving the country still, but it's mostly the young people who really don't see the future. I know a lot of friends and colleagues who have returned back in their 50s, 60s, 70s because it's home and that's where they want to be. So we can talk more, but no generalization, please.
Yeah, I was in the Balkans a couple of weeks ago, and in a strange way, while it seems there's both sort of contradictory trends, I think that there's actually the possibility to make another step in terms of normalizing relations, and in a way, in the Balkans, out of sync with some of the trends we're seeing, whether it's in the United States or elsewhere. So it could go in many different directions, some of which are actually very positive. I think I saw another hand. I'll take the Woman in the back, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. My name is Helena Finn. I'm a former U.S. diplomat, and I did have some direct involvement in all this. What I really want to ask you is, you've mentioned Mort Abramowitz a number of times, and he played a very important role. Whether or not there is cooperation these days, we will ignore Washington, but out in the field, whether or not there is constructive, positive cooperation on the U.S. diplomatic side from the career people, you know, the people who were like me.
Sure, there definitely is. I think that, I mean, when I was in Belgrade, Becca arranged for us to meet with the American ambassador, who is obviously predates the current president. And so there's still a very strong presence, I think, on the ground in the Western Balkans in particular, but elsewhere.
It was just announced a couple of days ago that Yi, that's his last name, is the Hoyt Lee Yi, is the new ambassador to Macedonia. It's one of the best choices that they could make, somebody in Washington who really cares for the Balkans. And I think that he, with the new government of Macedonia, will push the country forward very fast. But also, for instance, even though Croatia, we don't have an office in Croatia anymore, but we kind of consider Croatia still part of the region because we work with Croatia very much. Croatian ambassador, a very nice lady, was pulled out of Zagreb in 1 week's notice by the White House. So depends who it is and who. But as I said, at this moment, there are a couple of ambassadors, a very good ambassador in Bosnia, excellent ambassador in Kosovo as well. So it really depends on the personality.
Chargé in Budapest, which I recognize is not part of the Balkans, has been very, very outspoken in defense of freedom of the press, freedom of the media, in defense of the Central European University. So I think there's still elements of the diplomatic tradition.
I think it's generally recognized today that the greatest threat to civilization in the world today is, of course, between Kim Jong-un and Trump, these two crazy teenagers. Do you think the Open Society could find a place to help facilitate some kind of resolution? So,
no problem.
It is worth saying that the International Crisis Group, born out of this, supported to this day from its inception by OSF and George, you know, is doing a lot of work on exactly this and, you know, trying to identify, you know, what are the pressure points that have been missed at both ends to get the two sides to back down and try and find a sensible way forward.
Yeah. If you could identify yourself, that would be great.
Oh, sure. My name is Karen Kaplan, and I have a question kind of for everyone, just to end on perhaps pluralism and the press. I happen to be advising the Aga Khan Development Network right now, so we've been talking a lot about pluralism. I'm currently working with one of the male journalists from Bosnia Days, Michael Meyer, who is now the dean of the new graduate school in Nairobi. You had such a memorable group of people, whether it was George, Muslims, Jews, Christians, you all came together and you had this confluence of remarkable people. Do you have this chronicled where we could read these anecdotes and for it to inspire today in these difficult times of crises globally?
Some of it chronicled, and some of it, I think, lives on in either whether it's film or in, yeah. So we've done some of it ourselves, and others have done some of it. It depends specifically whether we're speaking about in Bosnia or outside. So we can be in touch for sure.
I would just say, you know, it was a remarkable group of individuals, unique, but what I have found, having, you know, in one way or another participated in a lot of the sort of global crises of the last 25 years, is that it's like a bright light that attracts moths. It's bright young journalists, their first overseas assignment, many of them, you know, taking a plunge and going actually without a contract and then offering to write for the Washington Post or the wherever, FT. It's the same with the humanitarian workers and the diplomats. You know, it's really extraordinary. And I still to this day do a lot with Afghanistan, which I've been involved with since the early days. And, you know, I look at when the crises of Afghanistan happened, when the Russians left, when 9/11 happened, you just saw an extraordinary attraction of the very best from every organization involved, because it was where people wanted to be to make a difference. And then, you know, things fall into a rut and the diplomats they send are the people they can't post anywhere else. The humanitarian workers like the special hardship allowances, but, you know, never leave their enclaves. And, you know, you just time after time see on the side of the international actors in these kinds of crises, this great influx of wonderful people, and then it all sort of settles down and a much less impressive crowd take over often, is my observation from outside.
I want to say something which, you know, I actually never said before. Yes, George made it all happen because we were working and spending his money. But Aria really helped do the thing. Without him, and without him really being on the helm of our foundation for such a long time, he always had an open door. My office was a couple of offices down the hall from his. And every time when I would pass by, he would call me like this, and I would come, and then it was always some question on the Balkans. So there was a question, how did we do it, and in the balancing, but without him, with the understanding, how can we help, and how can we really use the money properly, nothing of this would be possible. So thank you, Aria.
I think that'll be our last question. Thank you.
Hi, thank you. Marlena Spurry from Independent Diplomat. Listening to you today, it's striking how many parallels there are to today's Syria. And what we don't see necessarily is some of these creative solutions being applied. I wanted to ask, you know, do you see any room for application of these kind of creative solutions to really actually affect change and ensure that, you know, the UN and others are taking this more seriously?
Yeah, no, it's a really good question, because, you know, obviously the Syrian situation has produced some extraordinary innovations, particularly the white helmets. You know, but the white helmets, which is, I think everybody knows, I mean, these extraordinary Syrian civilians who, you know, go and rescue people in, you know, who've been injured in attacks, etc., and have just run and built an extraordinary sort of internal humanitarian network, precisely because, you know, as dangerous as we all claim Sarajevo was, and it really was, with terrible casualties, you know, actually, we were going in and out of it as internationals. Whereas in Syria, you know, the level of the fact that humanitarian aid workers have become a target has, you know, in some ways suppressed the ability of outsiders to play as creative a role as perhaps was possible in Sarajevo, because you need that interaction between the extraordinary people who are there and the outsiders to sort of come up with the solutions. So I think the situation has got a lot more difficult. And, you know, I agree with you. I've been incredibly frustrated. And I frankly goes to the crisis group that I chair as well. I just simply don't think we've been as imaginative in finding solutions for Syria as for earlier crises.
You know, I have focused on trying to get some kind of accountability for the war crimes, the crimes against humanity that have been committed in Syria. And different times. You know, I've offered proposals at one point. I thought I might be able to get some support for the notion of an Arab League court that would deal with war crimes in Syria. And it was not to be. Too many of the governments of that region felt that they might someday be called before such a tribunal, and they weren't willing to support it. There are other efforts that have been made, and thus far, at every stage, those have failed to provide a mechanism for accountability for the war crimes committed in Syria. So Syria is, to me, the greatest frustration of the contemporary period. I can think of nothing where there has seemed to me such wholesale failure by the international community as the situation in Syria today.
I think, and also with Bosnia, ultimately you had the ability with the international politicians. So whether it was who was heading the UN or who was in government in the various countries, and I think that we obviously are so far from that today. With Syria, yeah.
I mean, had to play the international, the geopolitical effort in making the Yugoslav tribunal effective. One of the critical things was getting a chief prosecutor. At that point, the Russians were determined to block anybody from a NATO country, and they would have vetoed. At a certain point, I was pushing an Indian to be the chief prosecutor, but Pakistan was a member of the Security Council. And even though the person I was pushing was chair of the India-Pakistan Friendship Council, it didn't work. Pakistan was interested in blocking. At one point, there was a proposal for an Egyptian-American who recently died, Sharif Bassiouni, to be the prosecutor. He was blocked on the ground that he was a Muslim, and therefore he would be biased in that. The way it ultimately, we ultimately managed to get Richard Goldstone appointed after about 14 other people had been considered, is that Goldstone had been appointed to the South African Constitutional Court by Nelson Mandela. And Mandela had given his approval for Goldstone to take a leave to serve as chief prosecutor for the Yugoslav tribunal. And the Russians felt that they had supported Mandela extensively during the period that he was in prison and in opposition to the apartheid government. So they didn't want to ruin their relationship with Mandela. And so they allowed the Goldstone appointment to take place. And if the Goldstone appointment had not taken place, the Yugoslav tribunal would never have become a significant factor. His personal credibility helped to make different governments willing to work with him and begin to apprehend people to come before the tribunal. So the geopolitical elements of this are always crucial. I'm sorry we didn't have Mabel Van Orange here today, because she worked on the geopolitical elements of it, and she did it extraordinarily well, and she would have added a dimension to the discussion this afternoon.
Well, as Becca said, we'll have to organize round two. I want to thank everyone. I want to thank the audience and everyone for coming and participating, and particularly the panelists, our colleagues in Sarajevo. I thank you for sitting in and being such active participants via video in the evening. And Becca, for organizing, Mark, and Arye. Thanks a lot.